Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. We're going to change gears a little bit today, talk a little bit about the big story in the national environment, talk about the war in Iran, what's going on there. And I want to flag for our regular audience, I know there's committee hearings going on at the Capitol. Stuff is kind of stirring over there, so we'll be returning to some of that in the next couple weeks. If you spent the day in state affairs at the in the House today, you know, my sympathies, you know, but back to work, such as it is. So for today, I'm very glad to be joined by Robert D. Moser, professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin. Longtime colleague and friend. Rob's been a member of the faculty in the Department of Government since 1995.
I'm one of the old hands.
An old hand. Immediately after earning his PhD at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I once spent a really terrific summer. I don't know if I've even told you that probably, but I was at the summer of 1985 in Madison doing an NEH seminar.
Yeah, I wasn't there yet.
No, you weren't. I was still in college, to be fair. But, you know, great university, great town.
Super cold up there for way too long.
Yeah, so. I was there in, I think, probably June to the middle of July. And I was going around telling people, man, this is great. And they're like, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, dude from California, yeah. Come back.
That's right.
Come back in February and give us a rave review.
You don't even have to wait to February. It starts in October and it ends in April.
Yeah.
That's called winter.
It's kind of like summer here.
6 months of winter. And so, no, it's a lovely place. I love Madison. When I went back there, though, I realized that my body had acclimated to Texas weather. And so it's just too cold for too long.
Very, very different. So, So Rob has been here since 1995. He's a full professor in the Department of Government, has played a lot of roles, chair of the government department, an associate dean, lots of other stuff, has been teaching, and this gets into why, one of the reasons I invited Rob here, other than just wanting to do this. But so you've been teaching the big Intro to Foreign Policy course with our colleague, Pat McDonald. I was trying to remember exactly when that all spun up. 2017?
No, 2014.
2014.
So we've been at this for 12 years now.
So more than a decade of teaching the Intro to U.S. Foreign Policy course, which
that's right.
Always contains an element of what's going on in the world. You guys do a YouTube,
exactly.
A video that you also, that is produced primarily for the class, but they can also be found on YouTube called International News Now, right?
International INN? News Now at UT.
There you go. You know. Good branding. Good branding.
INN at UT is the acronym that, you know, so.
And findable on YouTube and, you know, a great public resource and kind of consonant with a lot of the things we do in liberal arts ITS, where Rob is also kind of part of Rob's domain now for a few years. You know, producing stuff for instruction that also serves a public purpose.
That's right.
And your news, the INN at UT is a great example of that. Now, so I thought related to that, what I wanted to do was kind of leverage your comparative politics and foreign policy knowledge to grapple with how we might, and this is a tall order, try to make sense of the war in Iran and, okay. You know, what's going
on. 15 minutes or so.
Yeah, yeah. You and I have had several conversations about this offline, but it's been challenging. And so it's been kind of challenging for me to figure out what the best point of entry for this conversation should be. There's such a mixture of both near-term elements, big-picture elements. What I was watching your latest INN at UT, where you and Pat, I think, usefully framed for the students as kind of a systemic perspective on all this. So let's try to start at the broadest level. I want to ask you, like, how would you describe U.S. national interest in Iran?
Okay, so... So yeah, that's a good place to sort of enter in, right? I mean, the Trump administration's goals when it comes to how to handle the Iranian regime are very similar to the goals of previous administrations. They want several things. They want an Iran that cannot now or ever build a nuclear weapon. Now, that's not a novel goal to have. The Biden administration wanted that. The, you know, Obama and Bush administrations before them wanted that. And so that's a common goal. And it makes perfect sense. Iran is a an adversary of the United States. It wants very different goals than the United States. And if it had a nuclear weapon, it could leverage that nuclear weapon to threaten its neighbors, have more regional dominance, and even threaten the United States. And so the national interest of the United States in Iran, first and foremost, is that it not get a nuclear weapon, right? Secondly, and this is where the Trump administration started to broaden its ambitions when it comes to Iran. It wants an Iran that also can't use its ballistic missile program to threaten its neighbors and threaten other countries beyond the Middle East. And so the Iranian regime has built up a stockpile of ballistic missiles. Their missiles have gotten longer and longer in its range. And so that was a threat that they wanted to eliminate. And then the third pillar here is that they don't want Iran to be able to threaten its neighbors and the international order through these network of proxy militant groups in the region that Iran has leveraged through financing and influence. And these militant groups include Hamas and Hezbollah primarily, but also the Houthis in Yemen. And that helps to extend and project Iranians' power. And Iran's ambitions here is to threaten primarily, first and foremost, Israel, but then also other states in the region and to be a regional hegemon. That's the goal of Iran, and we don't want that, right? And for very understandable reasons. And so if those are the set of goals, this war in certain ways has been pretty successful, right? It has set back the nuclear program. Now, the nuclear program had already been set back by a previous bombing campaign that the United States joined in June of 2025. But this latest round of bombing on Iran further set back the nuclear program. It also definitely degraded Iran's military, particularly a stockpile of ballistic missiles. It kind of forced Iran to use a bunch of missiles, but it also showed that the United States, through its military capabilities, could shoot down a bunch of those missiles, and it destroyed a bunch of them. And so that was achieved as well. The same goes for the regional proxies, especially because we partnered with Israel. Israel has been attacking Hezbollah during this war, and that's part of this strategy. So if you put that together, you sit there and go, okay, this is a pretty straightforward operation. But it's not that simple, right? Why do we want all these things? We want it so that that region, the Middle East, and American allies, Israel, but also the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Oman, those countries that are allied with the United States are stable and safer, right? So you look at this war, and tactically it's been pretty successful, but strategically that's where it becomes more vague. Let's call it vague, okay. Right? And then here's the problem. Who's winning this war, right? So in a lot of ways, the Trump administration isn't wrong when it says we are winning this war. We have degraded severely Iran's military. But if you think about the goals of both sides here in this war, Iran is saying it's winning this war. Why? Not because it's defeating the United States military. It's not. It's because this has become an asymmetrical war. All that the Iranian regime needs to do to win, from its perspective, is to survive. And in this case, so far, the Iranian regime, the Islamic Republic, has survived. There has not been regime change. You could, you know, the Trump administration said there's been regime change. Not the way that political scientists and pretty much everybody understands regime change. Right. There hasn't been a change in government. There's been a change in leadership. They've removed a lot of these leaders. They killed a lot of these leaders. And so there's new leadership. But the regime is the same. And the regime's values and attitude toward the United States, toward Israel, its ambitions, it remains the same. It's still a hardline regime that's very anti-American.
And based on the same kind of institutional, organizational
exactly, the
principles, the structures.
Republican Guard, everything else. It's all there still. Let me ask you something
to inject something in there. I'm interested in how, and this was where I wanted to go anyway, because it speaks to both academic and political debates about the nature of U.S. positioning and U.S. interests in the Middle East. You didn't really talk a lot about economics in there,
right,
which is what we're hearing a lot about now because of oil flows. And obviously, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I had Bob Vitalis on the show after he wrote his Oilcraft book, which was really kind of a polemic about the left's preoccupation with reducing U.S. policy in the Middle East to oil. You know, I'm talking about, you know, how that denoted a kind of misunderstanding of markets and things like this. But I am wondering how you would plug that into this. Is oil kind of underlying some of these other things? Is it, you know, how do you work that in here? Because it's kind of the rub, right? It's one of the big rubs right now.
It is the biggest of rubs right now, right?
And part of it is just tactical control over the straits. It's sort of, but I mean, at the level we're talking about, how do you sort of factor that in?
Well, the way I would factor it in is that those goals, not allowing Iran to have a nuclear weapon, degrading its ballistic missiles, those are goals that a wide swath of the current, you know, political spectrum in the United States can agree on. But at what cost? That's always going to be a question, especially when you're talking about military intervention, right? And so we want those things, but we don't want those things regardless of what it's going to cost or regardless of what other sort of implications or ramifications for other interests we might have. And one of the primary interests is we want the global economy to continue to function and not get disrupted. And so when there was this idea that was floated that while we can't get Iran to come to a set of terms regarding its nuclear program and ballistic missiles that we're happy with, and so maybe we should use military force to press the issue. Well, that's when there was a debate like, well, if we do that, what would happen? And this is where you've got a problem for the Trump administration, because the cost has turned out to be extraordinarily high. Why? Because the Iranian regime has been able to counterattack enough to cause a high level of pain for the United States, but also for the whole global economy. And this is where the Strait of Hormuz is vital, right? Because Iran's geography, it's just an accident of geography, it can and has the ability, the capability to shut down the Strait of Hormuz. It's not any extraordinary military capability or ingenious sort of strategy on Iran's part. It just happens to be there. It's pretty easy. The strait is incredibly narrow.
It's low cost.
And it's very low cost. And it's hard to counter, right? The mines that they can lay, the level of military that it takes to threaten vessels enough that they're just not going to be willing to go through the strait because it's too risky, is easily achieved and hard to eliminate by any military, no matter how strong you are.
In some ways, that's an example of the asymmetry we're talking about.
Yeah, that's the example. They don't have to do much to have a leverage. And so the key point here is that they had a card to play and they played it. And that was the Strait of Hormuz. What becomes clear, and of course, like Professor Pat McDonald and I talked about this before the attack, and they said the one thing, the most risky part of attacking Iran is that Iran could close down the Strait of Hormuz, and this would cause economic disruption in the global economy. Now, that's never really been done, at least in the last, you know, decades, but Iran, prior to the attack on from the United States and Israel, said it was going to potentially close the Strait of Hormuz. They did military exercises showing that they
could,
you know, they could, and here's how we are do it. And so they tried to signal that this is going to might happen. And so don't attack us in the first place. The Trump administration decided to move ahead with that, knowing that that might be a risk. And I'm sure believing that either they could wait out whatever, you know, disruption might come from the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, or degrade their Iranian military and its regime to such an extent that Iran would have to capitulate within a short amount of time, and it wouldn't matter, or something. There was some sort of decision that said this won't be a problem. Well, it is.
Well, just to poke at that for a minute, I mean,
and you know, if you talk about national interests. Yeah, we had a national interest in doing all those things to Iran. But if anybody would have said, but if we're going to do that, it's probably going to mean closing the Strait of Hormuz and oil prices going way over $100 a barrel for an extended period of time, in which it's going to cause, you know, markets to
tons of shake
and all these things, then a lot of individuals would say, well, let's not do that. Right. And so that's your tension.
Well, so. I don't want, you know, look, neither you nor I were in the room. We're relying on secondary, but I it was a big piece in the New York Times a couple of days ago that I know we both read by Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan that takes us into the Situation Room, the meeting among the principals. There's a lot of things one, you know, you could do a podcast on deconstructing who was in the room and who wasn't and the reporting on it. But I reference that only because it does seem like it's fair to make the judgment that's implied in your comments. I just want to tease it out. I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
Sure.
But that they underestimated the degree to which this might have been a problem.
Yeah, it's fair to say that. I would say, I mean, I think
that— I mean, how could they have not, it almost seems like, to me?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is where I'd say you have to wonder what was—we weren't in the room, so we don't know, right? What was being told to the president who ultimately made that decision regarding the risk and the options to counter that risk— were.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I think that this isn't the first time that American presidents overestimated the ability of the American military to overwhelm a smaller and weaker adversary, right? You could go back to, you know, asymmetrical wars in Vietnam, and you find this a similar dynamic. Asymmetrical war is very hard to game out, right? Because it's built on the idea that a weaker adversary is going to be able to sustain incredible losses and sustain a level of pain that, you know, the United States would never be able to sustain. Yeah. But that's oftentimes how it continues to play out. You know, you look at the war in Vietnam, but you go to the war in Iraq, you go to the war in Afghanistan.
You go to the war in Ukraine, maybe.
Right, and you go to the war in Ukraine for Russia and against Ukraine. These weaker adversaries, when they're playing, when they're fighting for their very existence, have incredible tolerance for pain and a will to fight on. And it's very hard for countries and their governments and their leaders to, they understand it, but they don't know it. You know, they can't, it's hard to imagine that, that an adversary could risk all of that. I mean, this was a huge risk for Iran. Eventually, Iran is going to be held responsible for closing the Strait of Hormuz, especially after now we have a ceasefire and they sort of, you know, continue to control that strait at the cost of the international economy. The blame is going to shift. And so how long can they actually get away with that without everybody...
Well, I think there's a blame by who factor there that's already playing out.
Oh, yeah.
I want to get to that. But that's a good transition. So let's zero in a little bit on like the moment.
Right.
You know, what do you make of a ceasefire and, you know, how it's playing out at the moment as the U.S. and Iran get set to negotiate this weekend? We're recording Thursday afternoon in the lunch hour. And, you know, as of this moment, the way I would read it is the ceasefire is in place, but very unevenly applied. There's the factor, you know, there's the factor of what the Israelis are doing, what the Iranians are still doing, what Iranian proxies are maybe doing out there. There's a lot of uncertainty, but, you know, the way that I read it is that both sets of leaders have a lot of incentive to stop the fighting right now in the Iran and in the U.S., but also under some pretty difficult constraints, as you were beginning to allude to. So what do you kind of make of where it stands right now and how, what the prospects of this ceasefire being a foundation for the war not continuing?
Well, surely there's, I mean, the best way to describe the ceasefire right now is tenuous, right? I mean, there's not a guarantee that there's even going to be a negotiation this weekend, right? Because the sticking point, and a very big one, is the fighting in Lebanon with Hezbollah, right? If the Iranians say that ending the fighting in Lebanon is part of the requirement of the ceasefire and thus a requirement for negotiations to move forward, Israel is saying that it is not part of the ceasefire, and so we're going to keep going. And the United States has so far said the same, that this isn't part of the ceasefire. That alone could end this right. thing.
Let's stick with that for a second. I'm curious what you think, because I can't quite sort out how much of this, I mean, you know, basically the Iranians are saying, no, this is what we understood. These are the things that we understood we were talking about. The U.S. is saying, these are the things that we understood we were talking about. On one hand, you might say those two lists are simply the opening bargaining positions, which is inevitably partially yeah. true. But there also does seem to be an element of a lack of consensus on what the terms were. I don't know. I mean,
yeah, no, there was definitely a lack of consensus on what the terms are. Let's face it. We had an ultimatum. We were on the brink of a large scale escalation if there wasn't a ceasefire. And so, as often the case, when we have these sort of confrontations under the Trump administration, it gets to that point where it looks like there's going to be an escalation. And then there is an announced deal, right? At the 12th hour, at the last minute.
And a lot of times deal in quotation marks. Right.
And it's a deal that has no details, right? And right. so it's a deal that achieved its primary goal, which is let's not escalate, right? And so there was a similar situation in that whole conflict between the Trump administration and NATO over Greenland, right? It looked like it was going, and there were threats about using military force and all sorts of things between the United States and a NATO ally, Denmark, to take over Greenland. And then there was a deal and everything, you know, de-escalated. Well, the deal had no, like, set of details that made it for a deal.
There's nothing in it.
Right, exactly. And so the details will be worked out later. And so it seems like there's a similar pattern here, right? They needed to take a step back.
By they, you mean?
The United States and Iran needed this, there to be a ceasefire deal on Tuesday by 8 p.m. Eastern time.
Each for their own reasons.
Each for their own reasons. The United States really wasn't going to be well served, in my opinion, by escalating this war, right? Because, sure, for a variety of reasons, I'm not going to go into all of them, but it was probably something that they didn't really want to have to follow through on, and this allowed that off-ramp allowed them not to. But Iran really didn't want this to happen either. They didn't want to have to escalate in response. They also didn't want the damage to civilian infrastructure, because that's going to be hard to come back from. And, you know, you hear reports that China leaned on Iran to take a step back so that it doesn't get wider and bigger and things like that. So,
and China highly dependent on
the oil in the Strait of Hormuz, right? And so there was a lot of actors who had very good reasons to press for something that looked like a deal. And so they announced a deal. And because of that dynamic, it's not that surprising that there's two lists that are looking very different from each other. The United States saying ceasefire, and in response, Iran reopens the Strait of Hormuz without restriction, and Iran saying a ceasefire that includes everything, including Lebanon, and we'll reopen the Strait of Hormuz, but we're still in control of right. the Strait of Hormuz. And so that the discrepancies there don't surprise me. Now, you've got 2 weeks, but they better sort out what the actual deal is, or you're going to find that.
Because those 2 weeks ago, they're going to be back where they were with brinksmanship on both sides that right. they have a hard time stepping away from.
Right, exactly. And, you know, both sides, once you, the power of a ceasefire is that you have mutual benefits for both sides in a ceasefire. And that provides some sustainability of the ceasefire. The United States and the whole global economy really doesn't want a resumption of the fighting here, right? I mean, it's terrible for the global economy. And even the prospect that the Strait of Hormuz is going to not really get reopened over some protracted period of time is driving oil prices up already again. Right. And so, and the Trump administration can't want that, right? That one of the reasons it wants a deal that includes reopening the Strait of Hormuz is to take pressure off the global economy, right? The same thing on the other side. Iran can't want a resumption of the fighting.
The level of punishment.
But they have to extract some concessions here. They have to extract some assurances that the United, like once they reopen the strait, that the United States isn't just going to start the war again. And so, but you know, Iran's, when it comes to the Strait of Hormuz, because the geography is in a pretty good spot, it could, just like the United States could resume bombing, the Iran regime can reclose the Strait of Hormuz, it seems to me, at least.
And still, you know, despite the degradation of their production and their stockpiles, still seems to have had retained enough stockpiles and production capacity and stashed away weapons. And there's a lot of different numbers floating around in there I don't want to get into. But the fact of the matter is, even after several declarations that they had been really decimated, they've been able to launch attacks on allies in the region, including occasional direct attacks on U.S. forces.
Right? Exactly. And you've got the attacks on U.S. allies in the region that harm, again, the global economy and the regional dynamic here. The one thing that was not really in the cards here that the United States didn't want, and its, you know, Gulf allies didn't want, is to get dragged into this war and be targets for this war, and that's exactly what they are.
You guys had a good slide of the hazards of going to war before the war started. Yeah. I think maybe two INN at UTs ago.
Yeah.
Where there's, you know, very productive slide about
pretty prescient,
here's all the things that could be a problem, and you hit it.
Exactly.
Because of many of the, every problem we've talked about now was on those slides, and it's a little endogenous, but still, I want to talk a little bit more about these systemic factors, but I can't help but, and this is my sort of outdated training a little bit, but as you were talking about the explanations and the reasoning a minute ago about what was going on here, this seems like such a fascinating case, as we're right on top of it, for one of the big macro level debates in academic international relations and foreign policy about, you know, systemic versus domestic politics, internal versus external, and sorting out the way that, you know, if you get away from people that are staking their academic careers on one or the other,
right,
the way that they're intertwined.
Oh, I mean, completely.
You know, we're talking, I mean, as you kept saying, you know, the Trump administration or, you know, the United States doesn't want prices to continue to increase in for oil and all the secondary effects of inflationary effects.
Exactly.
In the global economy. But there's a very, you know, from where, you know, I spend most of my time looking at stuff, there's such an immediate domestic source of domestic political pressure in the United States.
Midterm elections.
From the midterm elections and the preeminence of the economy in those elections. I'm wondering just, you know, whether in this case or your years of sort of thinking about this, like you've been teaching this foreign policy class for years, you've probably introduced students to these debates a million times. I'm wondering how this, you know, if or how this affects your thinking about how you sort those out and what we have to watch.
Well, right.
It feels to me like your reflexive response is a little bit more systemic than domestic, but you talk about it, and I don't, you know, but
right,
you've also written a lot about domestic sources of things. So I'm just curious, right, how it's affecting your thinking right now.
Well, yeah, the domestic and the systemic, the domestic and the international have always been intertwined, and they go, and the causal direction goes both ways, right? I mean, outcomes of national elections, especially in big countries like the United States, have enormous systemic implications, right? Who wins the presidency, for example, in the United States affects how things go in the international economy and in issues of war and peace and in U.S. alliances around the world, all sorts of things. And so the domestic affects the international, of course, especially in democracies where there's periodic, you know, domestic mass politics that determine who the leaders are, and they, and those recurrent elections frame how the leaders are going to make decisions.
It's a repeated game for them.
Right, it's a repeated game for them because they have to gain re-election, right? And so, in this case, you've got this feedback loop that the fact that 2024 and its election ended up the way it did had an effect on where we are now in the international realm, right? And now that we are in the international, what happens to gas prices, for example, as a direct result of this war is going to have an enormous impact on midterm elections, right? And, you know, you're the elections guy, right? You're the pollster. The one thing that everybody understands is that these foreign policy isn't typically a big driver in, you know, midterm elections or even, you know, presidential year elections. It's always a secondary concern. And the main concern is economic and social issues, right? Well, there's nothing as more basic than the price of gasoline. Every time you fill up your tank, you're reminded about the direct effect of this war on your pocketbook.
And in the U.S. and particularly in Texas, you know, you're filling up your tank all the time.
All the time, right? You drive a lot. It's a big state. And so if that alone will have an enormous impact on midterm elections that were already a big challenge for the Republican Party
in that anyway, in that dimension,
right? Yeah. And so you've got, and because in the current domestic environment in the United States, the balance between the two major parties is so close, it doesn't take a lot to flip things over, right? And so, and midterm elections are always bad for the party that has the presidency. And so you tend to assume you're going to lose seats in the midterm elections. But, you know, in this kind of scenario where you've got real economic consequences of a foreign war, there could be a really big.
Yeah. And they're immediate.
Yeah, and they're immediate. I mean, and the elections are, what, 6 months away? Well, you've got to do something about the Strait of Hormuz within weeks, really, to even have a chance for the ripple effect to work through the system and gas prices start going down.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, I mean, when they made the agreement, everybody's like, oh, oil prices are plummeting. But they plummeted from, you know, I can't remember exactly where they were. We'll say for sake of argument.
$112.
Near 120, right?
Yeah, yeah.
115, 120. And they plummeted, but they settled around 90.
Right.
And now they're ticking back up.
Up toward about 100. I mean, what I would say, and I'm no, you know, specialist on energy markets and anything, the prospect of $100 a barrel oil going all the way until the fall is something that wouldn't shock anybody, it seems to me. And then when you have that, the current price of gasoline is not going to budge very much at all.
Well, and what I would say, I mean, on top of that, I mean, I would expand and kind of say, and, you know, the point I was kind of implying earlier is that even if it goes back down to 90, you know, the kind of projections were that it would be in the mid 70s.
Yeah.
And exactly. So even if it feels like it's even in the most optimal scenario, it's likely to settle higher than anticipated. And that's a real irritant in politics. Okay.
That's a real irritant. Well, let me just say,
go.
It's the same thing. Like if you think about the Biden administration and its problem with inflation leading up to the election. Inflation is always a killer when it comes to elections, because the only thing you can do as a national government is stop the increase from getting higher and higher. But prices rarely go back down,
right,
at least in the short term. And so the idea that, you know, you could kind of get the best case scenario in my book through 2026 is that the price of gasoline and energy just doesn't keep going up. It just starts to level off. But leveling off at this level is going to be an irritant to consumers across the country.
Yeah,
they're not going to be cool with $4 a gallon gasoline because at least it didn't keep going up. No one's satisfied with that. They want it to come back down to $2.70 or whatever it was before the war. That's not going to happen.
And it's kind of just a, you know, slightly pulled out of my butt theory here. But I mean, I think one of the things that, to use the word we've been using, amplifies that irritation is that if you're under 50 or so, you don't have any personal historical experience with periods of sustained rising prices.
Right.
And inflation. You just don't. And so those expectations that you were referring to that, that punished the Biden-Harris effort, where people saying, well, you know, look, the numbers are better now, so it's cool. It's a loser.
Yeah.
And it's a loser. I think, you know, the Trump administration has veered kind of closely into doing that.
Exactly.
And now not only do they have, you know, the fact that that was, no matter what's going on, that's not a good argument. Now they don't even have objective conditions to point to that might say, well, it's lower, because it's not lower.
It's right? not.
So we need to wind up, but it would be malpractice for me to not ask you, who back in those, you know, the halcyon days of your time at the University of Wisconsin and your early days as a faculty member here, you know, your core area is specialists in Russia. You
Yes.
Did research on Russia. You spent time in the former Soviet Union, in the Soviet Union, then the former, as it was becoming, I guess, the former Soviet Union and
exactly.
and the states, Russia and the states of the former Soviet Union. You know, one geopolitically, there's an argument out there that I find fairly convincing, and I'm wondering if you agree that all of this has generally helped the Putin regime in Russia and generated some advantages for them in this ongoing war with Ukraine. Is that right? Can you tell us about
completely.
That?
Completely. One of the biggest winners in this war so far has been Russia. And the reason for that is pretty straightforward. The war in Iran created an energy crisis that then made the chief source of revenue for the Russian regime, oil, more valuable. And so Russia was under heavy sanctions by the United States and its European allies because of the war in Ukraine, and it was selling its oil at a heavy discount to customers like China, right? And so it was hamstrung then in terms of just resources to propagate the war. Now, it managed pretty and kind of for a lot of us, including myself, surprisingly well that they kept its war machine going. But there was always a huge drag on its ability to prosecute the war in Ukraine. And now that this energy crisis has raised the price of oil in general, meaning also Russian oil, but also has driven the United States and the whole global economy to say, well, forget about sanctions on Russian oil. We need this oil. This is an emergency. Yeah. Has helped Russia tremendously. But that's not the only reason, right? I mean, from a strictly sort of security and military angle, the war in Iran has, again, brought focus and exacerbated tensions within the NATO alliance between the United States and its NATO allies. And this is just another reason for the United States and its NATO allies to be sort of at odds with each other because the United States has engaged in a war that it didn't consult its NATO allies about. And so then when it reached out to its NATO allies, they got a very cold reception for assistance. And the Trump administration resents that. Well,
it reinforced pre-existing notions about NATO and the Trump
exactly,
White House.
Exactly, especially, you of know, course
fairly,
it did.
I would say slightly. It wasn't, the way that you describe it, slightly right. Unfair is the wrong word, but kind of, you know, it reinforces their preconceived notions of NATO, not all of which were completely sound.
Right, no, and this isn't, it's not like the war in Iran ruined the relationship between the United States and its NATO allies. That had already been accomplished by the controversy over Greenland and the Trump administration's questioning of the NATO alliance ever since his first term, right? So there have been tense relations here, but this doesn't help. In fact, it hurts a lot more. And there's this concrete argument coming out of the Trump administration, and one that is hard to counter in part. So the European allies are saying to the United States when it asks for help in reopening the Strait of Hormuz, which is, you know, one part of this conflict, right? That they could probably, each side could probably get over, right? No one has been able to kind of crack that code yet of reopening the Strait of Hormuz. But the fact that European allies says, no, this is your problem. You started this, you know, that they didn't appreciate that. Okay. But the real problem, I think, is the access to bases and the access to airspace. When NATO allies like Spain said, you can't use bases, you can't use our airspace because we disagree with this war, and you know,
you didn't consult us,
you didn't consult us, and all of that. This is, and they kept using the phrase, this is not our war. Well, what the Trump administration has been saying, well, Ukraine isn't our war either, And so when you start getting into that dynamic, there's a real risk that because of European allies refusing to assist and come and sort of collaborate with the United States in the war in Iran could lead to this tit for tat thing where, well, we're just going to, you know, cut off our support and our involvement in the war in Ukraine, just like you didn't help us in the war in Iran. And if that happens, that is a huge advantage for Russia. And so that's how Russia wins on this.
Very consistent with what I understand to be one of Putin's foreign policy goals for a long time, which is to drive a wedge between the U.S. and
Europe. Of course. And that's been and is and will continue to be his primary objective when it comes to the United States and Europe and the NATO alliances. He would love it if, you know, there was a permanent rupture in NATO. That would be music to his ears.
And there's an interesting sort of to go back to our notion of asymmetric warfare. It's a piece in either the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, I think, one of the major dailies that you probably saw about the Ukrainians now shifting to really focusing on oil infrastructure in Russia.
Yeah. Well, I tell you.
It's a sensible approach.
It's a sensible approach, right? I mean,
there's questions about how, you know, and what I read about just how much damage they can really inflict on that based on this, where the oil is at any given time and how Russia generates the revenue from that oil, et cetera.
Exactly. And they knew that before this too, right? They have been targeting.
Picking at it.
But they couldn't. There is a question of whether they have the capacity to do the kind of dramatic damage that would make a dent in Russia's oil production, but the ability of small states to leverage energy politics to their advantage is even more clear now by the dynamic over the Strait of Hormuz.
Right.
And so Ukraine is paying attention, right? And that makes perfect sense that they would try to use the capabilities it has to hit at the resources that really make a difference, right? And so this is one of the key lessons of this war is that I saw an article about choke points, and Strait of Hormuz is a classic choke point. And you don't need a lot of power if you have access to a choke point against a much stronger adversary. All you need is that control over that choke point. And the Strait of Hormuz is the clear, classic example of that. And it's playing out in front of our eyes.
Good definitive statement to end with. Rob, thanks for coming.
Hey,
I know
happy
you had
to be
a busy,
here.
You had a busy schedule and appreciate you making time for us.
A lot of fun. Thanks very much.
Good. So with that, thanks again to Rob for being here. Thanks to our excellent production team here in the Dev Studio in Liberal Arts Instructional Technology Services at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks to you all for listening. Keep an eye out, and we'll be back next week with another Second Reading Podcast. Have a good rest of the week. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.